Good afternoon. May it please the Court, I'm James Laughlin on behalf of the appellant Victor Ramirez-Martinez, and with the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve a few minutes of my time for rebuttal. The evidence presented in Mr. Ramirez's trial was insufficient to support his conviction. I recognize that this issue should have been raised at the first appeal, and I apologize for not doing so. But as I explained in the brief, the Court does have the discretion to reach this issue, and it should exercise that discretion here. After all, the insufficiency issue hinges entirely on a legal issue, and that is whether an alien is found for purposes of Section 1326 when he simply obtains a state driver's license.
Counsel, assuming that that question can be raised in this second appeal, was it raised originally at the time of trial? It seems to me that your entire theory had nothing really to do with the issue that you're now asking us to decide, but rather that he had never been deported. That was the theory of the case. So even assuming that there's not a problem with not raising it in the first appeal, why is this a proper subject for us?
Well, Your Honor, you are correct that the only disputed issue factually at trial was that other issue that you mentioned, and this specific issue was not argued to the jury. However, there was a timely Rule 29 motion made, which I believe preserves all of the insufficiency issues, and therefore the Court's regular standard review would apply. However, the Court really doesn't need to go there, because as the Court noted in a case from last year, Cruz, drawing on some earlier cases, the issue would still be reviewed for plain error. And the test for insufficient evidence is so stringent in and of itself that the Court said we can't really contemplate when there's going to be a case where there's insufficient evidence that doesn't amount to plain error.
Why isn't this, in a sense, invited error? Because it was more than just not raised. I mean, whoever it was said in the opening statement, the only issue in this case that's in dispute is whether the person was physically removed. There was really no reason for anybody to bring in evidence or make arguments at trial that might have cured this problem if it had been timely raised.
But the government still has its burden, right? So the government's indictment alleged a found-in date of July 14, 2004. But what it proved was a found-in date of July 2007, and that's what it argued.
Correct.
So I don't know how I'm going to come out on this case, but it seems to me that the question of what does found-in mean was not clearly understood either by the person who drafted the indictment or the DHS agent who testified or the lawyer who tried the case. And I'm not sure what definition of found in everybody was relying on in this trial. This seems to be, first of all, it's a new argument, but secondly, it seems to me that there are boats, ships passing in the night as to what date was really argued and presented to the jury as the found in date.
Well, I agree with Your Honor that this case has been muddled from the get-go. And in fact, it seems odd to me, if you go back and look, if you look at Trial Exhibit 20, which is in the government's supplemental exhibits of record, that's the printout of the state driver's license. Apparently, they got that on March 6, 2007. In April, they obtain an indictment for him, for a 1326 offense using the date he got the driver's license, July 2004, as the date of the offense. Then they go out looking for him. The INS or the BICE agents don't actually pick him up and find him until a couple of months after he's been indicted, which to me seems like putting the cart before the horse, given this court's case law, that a 1326 found-in offense does not crystallize. In other words, does not...
It doesn't end. It's a continuing offense that ends when the person is taken by the Immigration Service.
The court does say this is a continuing offense, but I think in Ruelas-Aguillon, the court tried to kind of parse out exactly what that means in this context. Let me distinguish it from a different kind of continuing offense. When somebody escapes from jail, as soon as they get out of jail, they've escaped, and their escape offense continues. It's over. It's complete, but it continues as long as they're out and they're not recovered. Here, I think what the court was saying in Ruelas-Aguillon is, and if you look back to a case before that, Hernandez, where the court recognized that Congress has not said that simply being in this country without permission is a crime. You need to be found. And so in Ruelas, what the court said was the crime crystallizes with official discovery, and I think that what that means is it then relates back to the last reentry. But I don't think it's the same thing as to say that the crime begins and is prosecutable at this earlier stage.
Is it your contention that the founding date is an element of the offense, the date, not the fact of being found in, but the date of being found in is an element of the offense? And if so, is that consistent with our case law?
No, I would not say that it's an element, and I think this court addressed that very issue, and I'm going to butcher the name here.
I can't pronounce it.
I believe. Close enough. In that case, what the court said, because that's what the government made the argument in that case, and what I think the court said was that may be true, it's not an element, but it's irrelevant, because there's still the constitutional standards of proper notice and double jeopardy protections that come into play in putting time and place allegations in the indictment. And when you don't have a date that's reasonably near the date alleged in the indictment, then these problems come into play. And then, as the court recognized in that case, you have a fatal variance.
Yeah, that's the question I wanted to ask you also. Is your argument really sufficiency of the evidence or fatal variance? Because I understand one's sort of structural and one, I mean, I don't know, one would require us to, would both require us to reverse the conviction if we agreed with you.
Correct, Your Honor, and I, too, was confused about exactly how you go about this, and that's why I followed the path that the court took in Tocinahinit-Ginny, which was to say they viewed it as a sufficiency of the evidence issue. They found that because of the fatal variance, the evidence was not sufficient, and therefore they reversed with orders to enter a judgment of acquittal.
Well, that's what you're basing your argument on.
Correct.
The variance. He was not found until March of 2000. He was charged with having been found in July of 2007. Based on the fact that he applied for a driver's license in July of 2004.
Correct.
You got 3 years, and it's a variance.
Correct. And because of that variance, the government didn't present sufficient evidence on the charge that was actually alleged in the indictment.
Yeah.
Because they had to prove something reasonably near that date. And I believe Casterline did the same thing. They looked at it as if we're going to look at it at the issue as a sufficiency of the evidence in the sufficiency of the evidence framework. And if there's conduct that's outside of the range of things that are reasonably near, then there's not sufficient evidence.
Well, if we were to view it as a question of variance, is that a waivable problem?
I'm sorry, waiverable?
Yes, it was not raised at the trial court in time for it to be addressed by the evidence.
I don't think that would be. I think that it would be reviewed for plain error. I don't think it may be forfeitable. But
it's structural. Am I under a misconception there?
That the
fatal variance is a structural error?
Yes, and that's why I think it would satisfy an under plain error standard. It's because of the fatal variance that we have double jeopardy problems that are the reason why relief needs to be granted of some sort.
Let me ask you something else, because as a practical matter, I think no one thought about what does found in mean during the trial, because it only became important at the sentencing. It became an issue at the sentencing because the earlier date would bring in the extra sentencing enhancement and the later date wouldn't. So that's when people started thinking about what is the correct found in date. So it came to us, and we said, but for purposes of sentencing, what is the correct found in date? And so we sent it back to the district court to, I thought, when we send something back on an open record, to admit new evidence. Was he found in 2007, or was he? What's the evidence that he was found in 2007 versus the evidence he was found in 2004? And then you would apply a preponderance of the evidence standard to that. And it seems to me the only thing that happened at the district court level was that the government talked the probation officer into changing the date in the sentencing recommendation. Am I correct that the judge did not take any new evidence on the found-in date?
No, Your Honor. That is correct. The government convinced the probation office to adopt the same argument made here the last time, which was the date in the indictment is dispositive, so you don't need to look any further. And then the court adopted that. Interestingly, if you look at both the addendum to the PSR and when the district judge was talking about that, they do that in language that says that the offense was complete on the date he got his driver's license in July 14th, 2004, which to me says we now, for the first time, this court has never said that you have a complete found in 1326 offense without any official discovery whatsoever.
See, there's this other case, I can't remember which one it is, but where state officials took him into custody, and that was the found in date, even though the defendant had not been taken to the DHS or ICE, the immigration officials. So they used the earlier date. But I was thinking that maybe that's an okay legal distinction because that's law enforcement. And when the law enforcement agency finds them, they're going to find that he didn't come here with permission from the Attorney General. What it seems that we're being asked to hold is that mere contact with the government satisfies the requirement of found in for purposes of the statute. So it could be filing your taxes. Getting a library card. Going to the county hospital.
Perhaps even every day you get your mail delivered by a federal post officer at your house.
And I just don't think that can be the line.
Or buying a dog license.
Correct. There's lots of interactions that aliens have with government services on a daily basis, and once you go down that road of multiple findings for what is in essence a single offense, then I think you have lots of double jeopardy problems because it's really unclear then if somebody gets convicted.
I don't understand why that would be the case. I understand your other arguments, but the double jeopardy argument, we do have cases that say that it is illegal. That founding offense commences with the illegal entry and ends with the ultimate apprehension at the end of the road. And we also have cases that say that when there's a single continuing course of conduct, you can't be charged with more than one episode. So under those settled principles, I don't understand why there's a double jeopardy problem. There may be other problems, but I don't really understand why you think there's a double jeopardy problem.
Well, let me use this case as an example, Your Honor, because especially when you have a 3-year difference like you do now, the government contends that they properly charged him with being found when he got his driver's license in July 2004. They also say in the brief, if they wanted to, they could have just as easily charged him with being found in July of 2007 when ICE agents...
But not both.
But not, well, I don't. They don't say not both, but what they also acknowledge is that if he had left the country in the interim, there were two different offenses.
Well, that's a very different situation. If a person keeps leaving and coming back and they're found each time, they have committed, even under your theory, several offenses.
But the problem is when the government does what it does here and alleges a 3-year spread, basically, between the founding date that it alleges and the true founding date that ends the offense, which is official discovery, I think it has to be incumbent upon them to show, it then becomes their burden to show that there was no intervening leaving of the country, because otherwise it isn't part of one single arrest that culminates and crystallizes in the official discovery.
That's another question I have. Is there any evidence in the record, one way or another, as to whether or not your client left the country and came back during that period of time?
No, Your Honor. In fact, that was the majority of the issues we were discussing the last time we were here, was the absence of such evidence, at least for the five-month period from February to July of 2007.
Well, did the district court, who's the district court judge here?
Judge Walter.
Judge Walter. Did he hold an evidentiary hearing where you would be free to introduce this sort of evidence, whether he came and left in between? That would seem to be relevant.
Well, we asked for an opportunity to have the kind of hearing that we thought was contemplated by this court's remand, which was to for the government to put forth whatever evidence they could to show that, that my client was here continuously for the 5 months preceding the July 2007 founding date. And instead, the government's first bullet in its gun was to argue that that's all irrelevant because the only date that matters is the indictment date, and both the probation office and the government thought that was the end of it. I'm sorry, I say I'm way over my time. I'd be happy to answer any more questions, but otherwise I will submit for now.
And the indictment date was
April of 2007.
April 2007.
So a couple months before he was found by vice agents.
And he was turned over to the authorities in, when, in July 2007?
Yes, he showed up voluntarily at the Long Beach Police Department on July 9th, 2007.
July 9th, 2007. And so the only evidence the government had before Judge Walters was that he applied for a driver's license in 2004.
Correct.
And that when you go in and get your driver's license or you have any official contact with any governmental agency, that's the date that you're found in.
That appears to be what the road the government's going down now, yes.
Suppose that it was 2009 when the INS agent found out that he made contact with the DMV in July 04. Would the statute have run?
I don't think so, because I don't think they could have gone out and found him.
You would not make that argument that the statute had run based on the 04 date.
No, I don't think so, because I don't think that counts as a proper found-in date.
And now, is there any legislative history that shines any light on what found-in meant in that statute?
Not that I've noticed, and I've read the court's several cases of trying to parse out what that means, and none of it's cited to legislative history.
We tried to find something, too.
All right.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jeff Mitchell on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start off by talking about the found-in date. The government charged and proved that the defendant was here in 2004. That was our theory, and that was the evidence that we introduced.
Is that the standard? Is that the legal standard that he was here? Doesn't he have to be found in?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what the government introduced as evidence.
So you're saying that mere contact with the DMV is tantamount to meeting the statutory requirement of found in. That's your legal position?
Our position is that the defendant can be found by anyone. The statute itself.
Did the DMV find the defendant, or did the defendant go to the DMV and apply for something which he was given? I mean, what did the DMV have any idea that he shouldn't be here, and so they could find him to be here?
Well, I think the question is, was he found in the United States? Not was he, or who was he found by?
Who found him?
Well, I don't think that's relevant for the question. Here, in this case, he was found by the DMV. But the statute says...
Wait, you just said he was found by the DMV?
Yes, Your Honor. When he posed for his picture and when he had his fingerprint taken at the Department of Motor Vehicles, he was then able to have been found. Now, the statute itself says that the defendant violates...
He was able to have been found, or he was found?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
You said he was once he had his fingerprints taken, he was able to be found.
That's correct.
Does that equal found?
In this case, it does.
Because
the special agent, Paul Milano, was able to query the databases and learn that the defendant was in the United States on July 14th, 2004.
Okay, but does that... What if he had left after that?
Well, that would have ended the offense, but that doesn't mean that it granted him immunity. And I think United States versus Rulas Arguin touched upon this. It held that if a defendant... Now, a defendant does not avoid a 1326 crime by failing to complete it. So in that case, completing it meant apprehension. So a defendant doesn't avoid the crime by leaving early. He still illegally reentered. He committed the crime. And if the government
didn't commit the crime of found in if he's not here.
No, if we can prove that he was found here, we submit that he did commit the crime. We don't.
You know, we looked up the OED dictionary definitions, and there seems to be no statutory history, legislative history here. And it says to be found is to come upon. So it seems like the ordinary meaning would fit more with what happened, maybe even. When your agent discovered the July 14, although I'm not sure of that, but when your agent came upon the defendant, would seem to fit with the ordinary meaning of that language.
Well, I believe that once the agent learned of the defendant or had reasonable certainty that he had come back, that only triggers the statute of limitations. The crime itself had already been committed, and I think the case law...
It's not how. And we know it wasn't crystallized under the case law.
Well, I think crystallized, I think in that court was merely stating the obvious, that you can't actually charge him until you've found him in that sense. But I think with the case law that's out here, we have cases that indicate that you can be found by state police officers, a parole officer, and then Jimenez-Borjas came out and said that it doesn't matter who finds him. And the court actually emphasized the word who. But this court has gotten even further.
But he still has to be found. See, I guess conceptually and as a policy matter, I'm having a problem with your DMV argument. Because the DMV didn't find Ramirez. Ramirez went to the DMV, so it's contrary to the ordinary language. And the other part of it, the policy part of it, is, I mean, obviously we don't want people who haven't followed the proper procedures to be in this country, but once they are, it's probably a good idea if they get their driver's license and they pay their taxes and they do all these things. I mean, one, it might lead to their being found Two, it means that they're at least trying to follow the rules of the United States. That's something we would want to promote, not discourage. So I'm just having a lot of problems with your standing by that argument. I think there's other ways you might be able to prevail, but I just can't, I see, it's like, I can't follow how you can say the DMV found Ramirez.
Well, I briefly, or briefly, I'd like to touch upon the policy grounds. If we hold that only immigration authorities can find the defendant...
I don't think it has to be that narrow. It would seem that, like, any law enforcement... In fact, we do have the one case that talks about he was in state custody. Any time you come to contact with law enforcement, you're found. I mean, obviously, you're... found by somebody that has the authority and ability to enforce the laws against you, to take you into custody. That's different than you availing yourself of a government service or trying to comply with the rules of the United States.
Well, local law enforcement are not able to enforce the immigration laws.
Oh, yes, they are. Under certain circumstances, what are they, 289s or whatever they are?
I'm not familiar with those, but
they
don't.
They get exemptions. Local police departments can get exemptions to actually, I mean, look at Arizona, for example.
My understanding is that local law enforcement does not usually have access to the alien files.
Well, they don't generally, but they can. And they can also refer. They can pick up somebody and contact ICE and say, is this person here legally or not?
Well, also in Guzman-Bruno, this court held that the defendant was still found when he showed up at his state parole officer in 1990. He was committing the offense both at that time and when he was apprehended by the local law enforcement.
Under your theory, could... I mean, what's interesting about the statute is it's in the passive voice, and that's what I think led to the decision that it doesn't matter who finds, because the crime is an alien who is at any time found, and it leaves open by whom. Let's suppose that an alien publishes a full-page ad in the local paper saying, I live in this community at such and such an address, and I'm very unhappy about the potholes on my street, and I invite everybody to my house on Thursday for a discussion on how we can fix the potholes. There's no contact with government at all in my hypothetical. Could the date of that ad that says, I'm here at such and such an address in the United States form the basis of a found-in date?
I think,
if not, why not?
I think it's a question of fact, and that's something for a jury to decide. I think as just a question of law, that the case law has been very broad and said that it doesn't matter who finds him. So, you know, based on the case law, we know that non-immigration officials can find somebody.
But my question is, why does it have to be an official at all? Why can't it just be proof of the fact that the person actually is found by anyone to be in the United States?
Well, the government would agree with that. We believe it's irrelevant who finds him. The only question is,
well,
was he here?
Check with a phone company and find out that he makes phone calls in this country.
Well, the proof would be difficult that the defendant was actually the person who subscribed there, but that would still be a question of fact.
Let's say he subscribes to it.
Well, then the government would put that evidence before a jury, and a jury would decide if that's sufficient to prove that it was really him and if he was really here. But the government's position is it doesn't matter who finds him. You know, the only question is, was he found to be in?
Our criminal laws are supposed to give people reasonable notice that if they engage in certain conduct, that they are liable to punishment under our criminal law. This doesn't do that.
Well, this defendant was warned that if he did come back to the United States, that it would be a criminal offense. But also in the United States versus, I think it was Ayala, the court.
You probably could have put in a some date in here, you know, it probably was the way this indictment was drafted. You put him down as found in July. What was the date again?
14th, 2004.
He happened found on that date. But what is the indictment charges him with being found in July of 2007?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I believe...
No, the indictment says 2004.
The indictment says 2004.
And that was the evidence that we introduced at trial. The 2007 date of his apprehension was never introduced at trial. During when I was laying foundation for his fingerprint card, I indicated that the fingerprint card was made on July 10th, 2007, the day after he was apprehended. But the government's theory was that he was found when he was when he applied for the driver's license. Now, during the closing argument, the government indicated that he was found in Longwood.
What day was he arrested on?
He was arrested on July 9th, 2007.
You were the trial counsel, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you argued that he was found in the United States on July 9th, 2007 to the jury, didn't you?
No, I didn't, Your Honor. In the closing argument, I indicated that, I believe my exact words were that, plus he was found in Long Beach. And I want to emphasize the words plus here because what I was attempting to show was that the fact that he was found in Long Beach merely corroborates the fact that it was him who applied. This is on excerpt of record, page 245. And it corroborates the fact that he remained here undetected until he applied for the driver's license, and that was just merely a few lines above, and the fact that this element was uncontested. But the jury instructions... a few minutes later, the court read the indictment to the jury with the 2004 date and instructed the jury that the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the events occurred reasonably near the date in the indictment, 2004. And at most, this would be, I believe, a non-fatal variance. I mean, to be fatal, we have to show that it affected his substantial rights and he was prejudiced. And for prejudice, I think there's two things to look at. One, the conviction himself, and then the second, the sentencing. For the conviction itself, I believe the question would be, if 2004 is the wrong date and 2007 is the correct date that we should have charged, would the outcome have been different if we charged 2007?
I think that's sort of the middle ground that I'm kind of coming to, is that... You did argue, I mean, you can nitpick now words like plus or whatever, but there was evidence by the FBI agent or the ICE agent. He testified he found him in Long Beach when he voluntarily came in after having learned of the DMV license application. And then you argued that that's when he was found in. I know you're now quibbling with the word plus or minus, but let's just... set that aside for a second. For purposes of the conviction, we can uphold the conviction because the only reason that this is important at all is for purposes of the sentence enhancement. And that's the reason we sent it back the first time, was because there's a non-fatal variance. You proved that he was found in July 2007. That's fine. It's not prejudicial. He was found, clearly found that date under all of our law. We don't have to create any new law. And that for purpose of the sentence, he doesn't get the enhancement. To me, that seems like a reasonable way to look at this case.
For the sentencing aspect, the prejudice would only occur if the government can't prove that he was here continuously between 2004 and 2007.
You never proved that. You never proved that. And not only that, I don't know, did you oppose the request for an evidentiary hearing upon remand?
There was no request for an evidentiary hearing. There was a resentencing.
Right, but we sent it back on an open record. My understanding of an open record is that you're allowed to introduce new evidence. You never introduced evidence, and it's your burden, that he was here continuously.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what I'm saying is you didn't meet your burden on the sentencing. So
Didn't he concede that point? I guess is my question to you while you're answering Judge Wardlaw's, when his counsel said that their theory of the case is that he has lived continuously in the United States since March of 1995 without ever leaving.
Yes, Your Honor. And we did introduce evidence at trial that the defendant admitted that he had never left the United States between 1995 and 2007. And that's been our whole theory of the case, that he was here continuously.
Right. So you're saying, I don't know what Judge Graber was reading from, that he conceded.
I'm sorry, I was reading from page 82 of the transcript.
Who's talking?
The defense counsel.
Okay. I'm sorry, your question was, Your Honor?
No, I was trying to figure out what, so the argument now keeps changing. The argument now is that you didn't have to put on evidence that he was continuously here because, I don't know if it's your argument, it's what Judge Graber answered my question with, that you're saying now that there was a concession or?
Well, I don't recall the concession, but our argument at sentencing was twofold. One, that he was here continuously. We introduced evidence of his continual stay.
And what was that evidence?
It was his, in addition to his theory at trial and his statements, I believe, during the first trial. There's also letters from his family, co-workers, indicating that he had never left here. There was no evidence in the record that he had ever left, that he was always here continuously. And now at trial, when we instruct juries about what is reasonable doubt, we tell them that it's not based purely on speculation. But here at the sentencing, when there's a lower standard, that's exactly what defense is doing. There is no evidence to suggest that he ever left, and their argument is based purely on speculation. The government introduced evidence of his continual presence, but in addition to that, we argued that he was charged and convicted with the 2004 offense, and therefore the 15-year time limit for the sentencing purposes starts from the 2004 and then works backwards.
Okay. When you determined in the indictment that the critical date was July 14th, 2004, he was actually picked up in 2007.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so you had that date. So why don't you put that date in the indictment?
Your Honor, I wasn't the USA who charged it.
I don't care who did it. Why didn't your office do it?
Your Honor, I can't speculate on why they did or why they did not.
Well, I'll speculate. They're not very careful.
Well, Your Honor,
the way they draft these indictments, or maybe they had in mind that if we make it 2004 instead of 2007, we can nail him for another 3 points and send him away for a long, long time.
Well, Your Honor, this isn't a question of innocence. He's conceded that he was here in 2004. And the indictment was just holding
him. It's a question of fairness, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's true if you'd have made it July or whatever the day was, 17, 2007, we probably wouldn't even be here.
Well, but then we would
be. Is that right?
I believe that is
correct.
Sure.
So why did your office put that in?
I would
speculate. Somebody there wanted to nail him with those extra 3 points.
I believe it would be to hold him accountable.
You have to reach out to all these cockamamie theories that you're found if you go get a license, or you're found if you go to the pond and get a license for your dog, or I don't know, you go to Disneyland and you buy a ticket. Why do you have to go through all of that? You do something that's clean and understandable, and not have to do it this way.
But then we would be rewarding defendants for successfully evading law enforcement, and I don't think that's the message we want to send. But even on
what has that got to do with it?
Judge Ferguson has a point that I find appealing, because we're supposed to give fair notice of what a criminal act is, and the crimes crystallize when you're found. So you have people here. We all know there's many, many people here who are undocumented. So they have no certainty. If we accept your interpretation of the law, they have no certainty as to what it would mean to make up a violation of that found in provision of 1326. I mean, you could have charged him on entry, re-entered, and that would be a lot easier than the found in. But this is what my theory is. I don't think it was malicious. I think maybe this is still the practice at the U.S. Attorney's Office, that you take the brand new lawyers and you put them in the indictment section.
That is not the practice right now.
But it was.
Yes,
was it at this time?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. I remember when that was the case, and the indictments were constantly being superseded.
That is my understanding as well.
Yeah.
Can you repeat what you said on this part of it?
That we currently do not have a section specifically for new AUSAs who craft indictments. At the present time, and also at the time when the indictment was drafted, it was drafted by a senior section AUSA.
But do you understand my point
still
about...
Still working there?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you understand my point about certainty? I mean, how would you address that?
Your Honor, I believe there is certainty. I believe that every one of them realizes, after they've received that notice when they are deported, that tells them that if they come back, that they are committing a criminal offense. That's their notice. And they know that at any point, if they're stopped and they're found by immigration, that they will be charged eventually. And every one of them, I think...
If they're found by immigration, you just said.
Yes, and that is when the statute of limitation ends, and that is when the offense ends. But as Jimenez-Borjas says, it doesn't matter who finds him.
He still has to be found.
Yes, and I think the difference that we're having here is the government is focusing on that the defendant was found to be in the United States on a particular day.
But you're adding words to the statute.
Well, found in the United States. And this court, understandably, is focusing on who was he found by.
Well, no, I'm not. Okay, I'm. Let's get that out. What does the word found mean? You have to do something to find somebody.
Well, I don't think it has to be an active finding of him.
See, it seems to me that's what the dictionary definitions say, though. I mean, I don't know what to go by. Since it's not defined in the statute, there's no legislative history that shines any light. So you look at the ordinary meaning of the statute, and it has an active kind of component.
Well, I would submit that Jimenez-Borjas says that it doesn't have to be an active pursuit or an active found by immigration. He just happened to have been caught and arrested and convicted by local police officers. And after that, he was then identified by immigration.
That's why I'm saying it doesn't matter. I kind of agree with Judge Graber. It's not the by, but there's still the found part.
Yes.
See, there he was found by police. He was found by the parole officer.
Maybe it's, I once was lost and now I'm found, Is that what it's all about?
I think is the government's position is that if we can prove that he was here at any point after the time that he illegally reentered, up until when he was either apprehended by immigration or voluntarily departed, if we can prove that he was here, then we have found him.
Well,
really strange sound.
Why didn't you put it in this July 17, 2007 date then?
Your Honor,
I mean, do you know of any other criminal statute that handles people this way?
In which way? Going back retroactively?
No, it just says, you know, that it goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on.
Why?
Every day there's a new crime. And you know of any other one like that?
Well, Your Honor, I think all continuing offenses do that, whether it's conspiracy, whether it's a scheme to defraud or escape. It's a continuing offense.
No, if you have a scheme to defraud, but see, this has, in other words, if you have a scheme to defraud, you're a crook. And this goes on and on and on and on and on. You know, that's one thing. But and you've got that criminal intent, you know, to harm others. But I suppose you're going to make an argument when you come here to this country, you have a criminal intent to harm others, and it goes on and on and on. But it seems to me that this statute just, whether you're here legally or illegally, you're entitled to the protection of the Constitution and Bill of Rights. Agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good. That's fine. And I got a case in there. I'm glad you read it. Because a lot of people have never heard of it. And the panel was Pregerson, Reinhart, and Norris. And make copies of it. Distribute them in your office. But it seems to me that what this statute is doing is it's treating people who are undocumented, who come here, more severely than as a class, than we treat other people. And I think it's discriminatory, because that's what it's focused. We're focusing on them. We want to make life hard for them. We want to make life hard for their children, so we can kick them out and just let the kids wander the streets. And this is an example of it, as far as I'm concerned.
If they send their kids to a public school, is that found in?
Yeah, they go there and register. They send their kids to school and the child is an outstanding person, and they write a little thing in there about the parents and how the parents have supported the kids and all that. Found in then?
Under the case law, I would imagine it would be yes, although I can't imagine anyone charging that. But the cases have...
Here's a guy goes and gets his license.
Well, Your Honor, this was somebody who was targeted specifically because he was a former gang member with prior convictions, and he was deported. Now, there was a special task force that was created to search for these prior gang members to determine if they had come back. And we only charge the ones who have aggravated felonies. But going back to Your Honor's earlier concern with just the offense itself, I think there was a case that kind of talked about this in context. I believe it was the United States versus, I'm going to butcher the name, but it was Ayala, which I've cited in my brief. Ayala, A-Y-A-L-A.
Ayala.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in that case, there was a discussion of a similar argument that a defendant made. He argued it was a vagueness argument to the 1326 offense, and he argued that the 1326 statute is a status offense, and that there is no actus reus, so therefore he is unable to curb his conduct to conform to the law. But this court rejected that argument and said there actually is an act. He can choose not to illegally reenter, and if he has already come back, he can voluntarily leave.
Yeah, I'm going to have to review the record on this continuous, on the evidence on the continuous thing, and I don't know if either of you have any more questions, but I definitely want to ask the defense attorney about that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I can see you're a good guy and you're suffering over this case. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask you something. Have you been in the PD's office for a long time?
About 9 years, Your Honor.
9 years. Did I know you from before?
I think we've met. I used to be partners with Michael Lightfoot, and I think we've met at a couple of his associations.
Lightfoot?
Yes.
Good guy.
He is. I'm sorry, Your Honor, did you have a question?
Maybe I should have asked the USA this. But, all right, so how many years has he served, and how much time does this enhancement add to what he's serving?
I have that. As of now, he's been in custody for about 33 months, which would be equal to a 39-month sentence given good time credits. He got a 92-month sentence, which was the low end of the applicable range, with the three criminal history points that were challenged in the first appeal and again here. Without those three criminal history points, he would drop down a range, and the advisory sentencing range would be 77 to 96 months.
77 to 96.
So yes. Theoretically, he could receive the same sentence, but he might not.
Well, Your Honor, I know one of the issues the court's going to have to confront if it decides to remand this for any reasons is to whether it should go back to the same judge. As I pointed out, Judge Walter actually said on the record, no matter what the Court of Appeals does, when it comes back to me, I'm going to impose a 92-month sentence. So
we see that frequently, and it's not necessarily recalcitrance. It's sometimes intended for judicial economy, because if there's a question, if let's say there's a question about a particular, whether something should be 2 points less or more, oftentimes the trial judge will say, look, here's the sentence that I think is the right sentence, and here are all the reasons for it. And if I have this range, it's in the middle of the range. If I'm wrong about that and it's this range, I would still give the same sentence because I think it's the right sentence. Is there anything wrong with that?
I think that particularly in this context, it does raise issues, particularly in light of the Supreme Court and this court's admonition to trial judges that the first step is to accurately calculate the guideline range and to keep that in mind as a starting point. To then say that, you know, no matter what that guideline range ends up to be, 92 seems to be the number I'm going to go with.
I'll ask the question I think was on Judge Wardlaw's mind. In the defense opening statement on excerpt 82, the following is said, since March of 1995, my client has remained in the United States. He was never deported. He has lived here continuously, contrary to the government's allegations in this case. So it seemed to me that the whole argument was he was never, ever deported. So he's been here continuously to the moment of this trial from 1995. Is it still open to you to now say, well, it's theoretically possible that he wasn't here from 2004 to 2007?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. I think so. In fact, the evidence that the government is talking about now is exactly, there's no difference in the evidence that he brought up during the first appeal. So what we're talking about is the opening statement and some letters that were submitted during sentencing about my client's employment and school history. And dealing first with the statement by trial counsel and opening statement, first of all, that's not evidence. And second, I think
but it may be a concession for the purpose of sentencing.
But I also think that even if that were the case, I think it had to be viewed in context. What those words in context were all about was he was here continuously. He was never deported by, he was never put across the border by the INS, which is what our defense is in this trial. It didn't speak in the broader sense of, and he's never stepped a foot out of this country for a day during that period, or, and certainly nothing about that statement related specifically to the time period at issue, which
was February. But a reasonable fact finder, given what was there, could conclude that he had not left between 2004 and 2007. Isn't that also the case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that would be pure speculation. And even in this court's recent decision in Nevels, which kind of discussed the importance of looking at evidence in the light most favorable to the government, it did recognize that it's the case law that says that speculation isn't enough to satisfy sufficient evidence is still good law. And I think what you have here is just the most you can do is you can assume, like, he probably didn't ever went across the border, but there's no reason to believe that he didn't do that.
Let me ask you one more question, and then we certainly have kept you a long time, but is it your theory that that whoever finds the defendant, even though the statute is in the passive, has to be somehow connected with the government? In other words, let's say a newspaper reporter goes through their community and publishes a list of names and addresses of everyone who is living in the community who is an illegal alien, their expose of the week. Can the date of that publication, if the facts can be proved to be true, form the basis of a found-in allegation, or does it have to be the government that initially finds the person?
I would say the answer is no, that cannot be.
Why not, under the statutory terms?
Because I think, and this is one of the points I wanted to address about what the government counsel said, one of his last things said before sitting down, which was saying that if we show that he was here during the relevant period, that means he was found. And those are two completely different things. Even if Your Honor's scenario were true, I mean, that
well, knowingly that's remains, but discovered, found is often, we say something was found or it was discovered. But it's discovered that the person has knowingly remained after entry.
But discovered by who? Everybody
well,
who reads the paper?
I mean,
perhaps if Your Honor wanted to go one step further and said somebody in the INS read that paper and on that day they discovered him, we're getting a little closer to what might be allowable. But I think that to just say that being found in some general sense, that happens every day. Every time my client went back to his wife and his mother, they found him here in the United States on that day. So there has to be some kind of official discovery. I think that this court's case law suggesting that official, because we're dealing with an immigration statute, official INS discovery, I think is what's required. I understand Your Honor's position that perhaps other law enforcement encounters might also satisfy that. In this case, it really doesn't make a difference because
it's a crime.
Right.
The nexus would be that someone who could make sure that crime is being prosecuted or and the law is being enforced would be where you draw the line. I don't know if we have to draw that line in this case.
Right.
We could certainly say getting a driver's license is not found in without drawing the line. Does it have to be? Because that is not an active act by the DMV. It's an active act by Ramirez.
Correct.
Have to go all the way to either one of your positions to decide this case.
I agree with that, and certainly that position would not result in any kind of conflict with Jimenez Borja because that's exactly what happened in that case.
Right.
He was convicted of that earlier crime. What year was that?
July 2004.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was
aggravated
15-year deal.
Right. It was 1990.
1990?
Let me double check that now.
What was that again?
You mean the nature of the offense?
Yeah.
A sale and transfer of controlled substance. It's on page 55 of the sealed excerpt of record, and which is page paragraph 35 of the pre-sentence report.
How old was he then?
I have to figure that out. He was born. Born in 1970, so he would be about 20.
About 20. And from then, had been convicted of that offense until he checked himself into the police station. Mm-hmm. How many years went by?
17, yes.
And as far as we know, during that entire time, there's no other record of committed.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, there are. The pre-sentence report lays out other convictions and arrests during that intervening time.
Right, but the one that was going to add, the one that added the extra 3 points, that would have been over with. That 15 years would have passed.
The 15-year period would have started to run on February 5th, 1992, when he was paroled in that earlier case. So that was the last time he was in custody on that.
So 1992, I've got these figures somewhere, 1992. So that would have, that date would have gone by 2007, somewhere in there.
Correct.
How old was he when he came to this country?
Five.
5?
Parents brought him over at 5.
Yeah, okay. Thanks.
So, after he, between 2004 and 2007, was he arrested for any crimes during that?
I don't think there are any arrests or certainly convictions during that time.
That would have been a found in, certainly.
Now, his latest conviction is 2003, and his latest arrest was October 2003. That didn't lead into a conviction.
So why didn't they, was he deported in 2003?
No, I don't believe he was.
Why not? He's certainly found.
Well, and that's why I think, Your Honor, I mean, this court's case law that talks about being found by immigration authorities, it actually says being found and identified by immigration authorities. And I certainly understand, like Your Honor says, many local police stations are now, taking it upon themselves to identify aliens. But they don't always do that. And so even if they're found in that I have him and I have him fingerprinted, if they haven't identified him as an alien, I still think it's questionable as to whether or not that could be qualify as being found for 1326 purposes.
I don't know why he wasn't deported in 2003.
Yeah.
Or found guilty of this crime in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, actually, and as the court said and recently in Cruz Gramacho, when they mentioned that the defendant had sustained 2 DUI arrests before he was found by INS officials, which means that they were, granted the issue wasn't put squarely before them, but they were clearly thinking that those prior arrests were not found in dates. It was only when the INS officer caught up to him.
See, to me, that would be arrested for DUI would be found in, because he was arrested. Right. They did something. They found him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What were his other offenses? You got the controlled substance.
1992, he had a second-degree robbery. And this is all the pages 55 and 57 of the pre-sentence. Driving under the influence, driving with a suspended license, misdemeanor resisting arrest, and another misdemeanor resisting arrest.
I thought there was a domestic violence, but was that just a complaint?
That was just a complaint and arrest that didn't.
Where did he live?
Okay.
Where did he live?
Yeah.
He lived in an area. His driver's license is for Wilmington, which is an area around Long Beach. It's not part of Long Beach.
Wilmington. Yeah. Okay. Just so he didn't live in my old neighborhood.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. We'll adjourn this session of the court. And
thank you, counsel. Both of you did a great job with it. Really commend them of the case. Thank you.